So what we've been doing to kick off the discussion sessions is asking the speakers to reflect on their talk and where they see it fitting in the larger literature, and then discuss briefly what they see are the biggest open or most challenging problems in their line of research. So maybe we can go in the order of the talks that were this morning. So Harvey, do you want to kick it off?
Oh, thank you. Yes. Well, I was questioning the standard line in the literature that let's say pre-general relativistic physics, there's a connection between temporal homogeneity and the conservation of energy. And in fact, it's often said that it's temporal homogeneity that explains the conservation of energy. And I was appealing essentially to a modern version of Noether's theorem, which is due to Martínez Alonso and independently Peter Oliver, which gives symmetries and conservation principles equal status. I mean, in a sense, this is not surprising because all of the physics is in the Euler-Lagrange equations. And in the Euler-Lagrange equations themselves generate symmetries. I mean, symmetries are properties of the Euler-Lagrange equations, and the conservation principles themselves are consequences of the Euler-Lagrange equations. And from that point of view, neither of these two things seems primordial from an explanatory point of view. And I think this theorem brings out this point rather nicely. But the price that you pay is that the one-to-one correspondence between symmetries and conservation principles is now reduced to equivalence classes of symmetries and conservation principles. That's essentially the point I was trying to make.
Well, thank you. Emily, do you want to?
Yeah. So I think that once one accepts that there is a good reason to take seriously the possibility of laws which operate at a sort of global rather than local level, it becomes very important to understand the relationship between global and local physics and to think about how we can make inferences about the structure of global physics based on what we know of local physics and what sorts of features global physics might have that would have observable consequences at our local level. So in my talk, I used determinism as an example of that, but one can imagine many other possible properties that we might imagine the global physics having, and then think about what consequences that would have at the local level. I think that while we have a variety of formalisms and theories which are starting to move towards this more all-at-once picture, most of them have arisen from us first writing down a local physics theory and then making it more global. And I think an interesting direction would be to try to understand what would happen if we kind of did the opposite procedure, if we started from the premise that laws operate on this global level and thought about how that would reduce down to local physics. So I think there's probably possible ways for theoretical development there that haven't really been very well explored since we normally pass through this local phase first before making our theories more global.
Thank you. Nicholas?
Yes, so I start from a very different point of view. I think we should take indeterminacy very seriously. We know about indeterminacy from quantum mechanics, even elementary quantum mechanics. If you have indeterminacy, then you also have indeterminism, and you have the passage of time in the sense that there is a time before a random event turns into an indetermined quantity turns into a determined quantity. And so this passage of time should also be described in physics, and particularly if you want to tell stories. And I thought maybe easy or the best place to start would actually go back to very elementary classical mechanics. And there, if you take the standard viewpoint with classical mathematics, you end up with the conclusion that actually even chaotic systems are fully deterministic. It's just an unfolding of the initial conditions. If you change the mathematical language and go to, for instance, to this intuitionistic mathematics, then you have a very different view of chaotic classical dynamical systems, where you really have a creation of new events as time passes. And this is now, of course, more a starting point than an end result. How far can we go along that? How illuminating is that going to be for both quantum and relativity and quantum gravity? Frankly, I have to admit, I don't know the answer to that question, but I still think it's an interesting new view of classical dynamical systems.
Thank you. Thank you. Misha?
Yeah, thanks. Can you hear me okay?
Yep.
Okay, good. I was good with the speakers, but no, at least you can hear me. So there are two questions, right? So as regards to the first question, like in terms of more what's follow-up developments from the talk and the results, there are many things one could look into. One thing that's quite popular at the moment is this idea of observing quantum observers, right? We have Friedman's friend and various people have written other papers based on the same idea. One could ask the question, what does an observer think when he or she observes the observer who says the clock was off, yet knows the time? I think there will be various answers here. I think depending on how the observer observes, he or she would either say, actually, yes, the clock was off, but they may actually say, oh, actually, no, the clock was on. But nevertheless, I think the spirit of the result will still hold. Another thing one could ask is, I don't think I said very too clearly, but I also pointed out that in the case where you don't want any constraints on the time between the events, there is a tiny probability of error in the protocol I presented, although that can be made arbitrarily small. I think one could develop more advanced protocols in which it is exactly zero. This wouldn't be significant from an experimental point of view in a sense, because there's always experimental error, even in the other protocols, right? Or to quote, I'm not sure who said this, but black ports are not completely black, right? In the sense that if you have destruct interference, there's always a probability that to actually hit due to some small mismatch of the amplitudes. But that's enough about kind of the kind of micro level in terms of development. On a more macro level, what I would say is that one way to view the paper is that there's this long running debate in science and philosophy. One way to see this result is that we've taken a theme in the sense of a clock cannot be, can we measure time of the clock stationary? Because if one could, this would have, this would provide evidence for one interpretation of time. And the point is that people kind of dismiss, philosophers have dismissed this as impossible. And what we say is that, at least if you there's a certain interpretation with interaction free measurement, which has been well studied in the quantum mechanical literature, if we put this together with this concept, we can actually overturn some of these viewpoints, at least if you agree with interaction free measurements. So more broadly speaking, there are many other debates and things in philosophy, but maybe we can re-examine from the perspective of different interpretations of quantum mechanics, maybe we can make some leeway and some progress. Another thing as well is it gives another viewpoint, another aspect of this interaction with measurement, because previously they were all done in space in this time. But maybe I'll stop there since.
Thanks, Misha. That's good. And Carlo.
Just a word since I've spoken last. I have been strongly pushing for bringing together communities. I always try to talk to philosophers. I think it's essential for physics. We have put together the KISS collaboration, which is quantum gravity, quantum information, to talk to one another. And so we're all very much looking for fresh ideas for cross-fertilization. This, however, doesn't mean that there are no well understood issues within each community, and long discussed and digested. And so one thing I would invite is, just let's not try to reinvent the wheel every 5 years or 10 years like it tend to happen. In quantum gravity, the situation is not at all that there's a mysterious darkness there and who knows. I mean, the situation is that there are very specific theories. There's string theory, there's asymptotic safety, there is a loop quantum gravity, which are theories of quantum gravity. Each one of them has its own way of addressing problems and a solid conceptual structure, one way or the other, which is not just pulled out of the air, is a result of decades and decades of discussion. It's not been easy in each one of these. And many questions have been discussed, rediscussed, alternatives thrown away, things clarified. The reason we don't have a theory of quantum gravity from this perspective is just because those theories are there and it's hard to have predictions to compare with experiments, which is what a lot of people are doing. Abai is doing, I'm doing, a lot of people are doing. So quantum gravity, it's some theories out there, strange if you want, because quantum space-time fluctuate because there's a superposition of causal structures, but they are there, well-defined and conceptually solidly defined. They are not to be reinvented from scratch. If there are fresh ideas, they're super welcome. But again, let's not reinvent the wheel. But I want to stop here because also there were the question from Lucian, from Harvey, and I'm more curious to hear reactions than preaching. Me.
Thank you. Thank you. So yes, let's go to that. We had a few questions. So I don't know if I remember them all. I know Emily had one for Misha, and I'm trying to remember if there was ones earlier than that. And I also know Lucian had one for Carlo, but excuse me if I'm forgetting any. Oh, and Harvey had one as well. Okay. So I don't know what order to go in, but maybe Emily, we can go with you, if to Misha, if you want.
Yeah, great. So Misha, I thought this result was really interesting and beautiful, but I do wonder if relationalists about time would accept that it refutes relationalism. It actually reminds me a little bit of Newton's bucket experiment, which Newton to some degree considered a refutation of relationalism, but we know from Mach that relationalism can survive that, provided we take account relations to, you know, the fixed stars or some sort of the background of things not present in the local environment. Mm-hmm. And I wondered if in your case, the relationalist might not similarly say the time measured by the switched off clock is the time relative to the rest of the universe, so we still don't need substantival time in that case.
So if the time switched off is relative to the rest of the universe,
yeah, so time is, even when that clock is not dynamically evolving, presumably other things in the rest of the universe
are still.
Can the clock measure that?
Yes, well, that's a very, very good point, actually. I think the interesting point here is that the clock, as it said, as by itself, is not. At least according to our mechanical description, called the description mode, is not interacting with anything else. So you would have to somehow argue how the clock would know or something like that.
It's very similar in Newton's bucket experiment, though. That's exactly the same as in the Newton bucket experiment, right, where you have a sort of isolated bucket which is not directly interacting with the rest of the universe, but the relationalist will still claim that that is how at the sort of fixed background is established in that case.
I mean, you could try and do the thought experiment where literally you have a region of space where there is no matter other than your clock and time, and maybe there you could argue, well, from a relational point of view of theory, we'll say within this region there is no time. At least the concept of time doesn't make sense. Maybe outside. Here we're getting down to the nuances of relative theory of time. And then in principle, in that context, you could say, well, maybe there's a flash of light that enters and leaves. And that would do the first unit. You could take the person out of the picture, is what I'm trying to say, right? You could just be an energy eigenstate of this spin system, nothing else. That could turn it on. And then you could have another flash of light that performs a second unit theory and maybe stores the measurement outcome on some.
Can I chip in here on this point?
This is,
yeah, go for it.
Yeah.
I want to finish. Sorry, Misha.
Okay. So, yeah, and then so you could do this thought experiment and argue like this. You would have to, of course, you can't throw away all matter from everywhere in the universe, right? I mean, that would be a bit of a stretch even for a thought experiment. But at least you could do this. There is the other issue, of course, of background. What were they called? Vacuum fluctuations, right? You could argue, well, is matter really empty? And this is something actually that philosophers have caught on to a lot, especially because the debate had also, you know, people. It wasn't just, you know, since the advent of quantum field theory, and we've known about vacuum fluctuations, people still discuss this, and the arguments are still going back and forth. So it's not that. This kind of pull a coffin and a nail in the coffin vibe of the arguments. So yeah, maybe I'll leave it like that because I think also Carlo wanted to.
Yeah, I think Emily's point is very good because it's a Newton argument is extraordinarily powerful in the Principia with a bucket. And we know that in some sense it's wrong, right? But it's wrong in a more subtle way, I think, than the way Mach first pointed out. And it's wrong physically, and that's the actual answer to Newton bucket in general relativity, because the water of the bucket interacts not with a distant star, which are distant by locality don't affect anything there, but with the local value of the gravitational field. So much so that because of the frame dragging effect, if you do the bucket experiment at the North Pole, the water becomes concave with respect to the frame stationary of the distant stars, because there's a local gravitational field. Just compute the metric there. So the water is interacting with g mu nu, which is a dynamical variable there, and the g mu nu has the effect that it goes like that if it moves in the reference station with respect to the Earth. So the same is true for the clock, and that's, by the way, is the point raised by Harvey in the discussion. So any the debate between substantivalism and relationalism, in my opinion, has changed dramatically before general relativity. So to formulate it, getting general relativity is to formulate on the basis of the knowledge of the world that we had before 1915. So, and in general relativity, the clock is interacting, it's actually interacting, affecting and being affected by the local value of the gravitational field. So I would somehow rephrase Emily's question by saying it's not just the rest of the universe, it's a local metric there. It's not, Misha, this doesn't change what you're saying, but that's...
Sure. I mean, the good thing about that version of Elimi...
Do you want to give you an opportunity to respond, Misha?
Elimi's argument is that I guess there you could really do the photon at least, where you really vacate all matter. So the gravitational field is close to zero. And then the clock itself doesn't... at least it doesn't depend on matter per se, right? It depends on these particular states. It also depends on your version of relativism, right? Because you could say, well, the clock itself, from the clock's perspective, there is no dynamics, at least in the interpretation. So from the clock's perspective, there is no time. Regardless of whether there's matter around it, for that, there is time, you know? And these are now in the subtleties of the if you want, the spectrum of relativism, right? So we're getting to the subtleties now. But there are more subtleties than perhaps I for the personal time illustrated in the talk. There are many, I think philosophers more recently have also discussed this in a lot of detail. But yeah, and also with respect to relativity as well. So this is something with respect to relativity and also with respect to quantum field.
Great, thanks.
But I think yes, these things. The more it's kind of like many things in philosophy. The more you actually think about them, the more you realize how subtle they are and how there are lots and lots of subtle points. And you can go and keep on going, which is good and very interesting.
Thanks, Misha.
Can I maybe jump in here on
okay,
that?
I also know Harvey maybe wanted to jump in too, but I'm not sure.
Okay.
But I don't want to stop the flow. So, Harvey, do you want to?
After you.
Or Nicholas?
After okay, you. Let me be quick.
And I just want to make sure we get to everyone else's questions because we only have 20 minutes. So,
So there's this, okay, Harvey made the point that clock don't really measure time in the sense that there is no reaction. And Carlo said, no, there's a reaction, at least in GR. But if my understanding is correct, we should conclude that the heavier the clock is, the larger the reaction. And hence, the best clock should be the heaviest one. But we know that the best clocks are atomic clocks, which are not very heavy. So it should be the larger reaction will be due to a large heavy clock with a large mass, isn't it?
No, I mean you want less reaction to have a good clock. You want the apparatus to be delicate, not to be making disasters. You want to maybe do something without affecting it. You cannot avoid affecting it, but as little as possible. Yeah. So small mass.
Okay, thank you.
I was originally wanted to ask Carlo a question about probability, but just before I do, I just wanted to make a remark about relationism and Newton's bucket and so on. I agree with Carlo that you don't need to appeal to Mach's principle, which in its original version involved a staggering action at a distance, the effect of these distant stars. But you also don't really need to go to general relativity. And the reason I say this is that we have a good model of relational Newtonian mechanics in the Barber-Bertotti theory. And that's a relational model. And it's absolutely clear that inertia arises in a relational way and it doesn't require anything like Mach's principle in its original form. I mean, Barber defends a new version of Mach's principle that was given by Poincaré, but it's nothing to do with the original Mach's principle. So you don't really... In principle, you don't need general relativity to understand how you can have inertial effects, such as the bucket effect, the curvature of the water, and relational space-time.
Yeah.
But the question that I wanted to ask you, Carlo, is this.
Maybe.
Your theory has probability amplitudes in quantum gravity. And the more I think about probability in physics, I confess, the more confused I get. First of all, there's the question, what does probability mean? Well, there's no consensus on this, even in physics, and I think we should probably put that question aside for the moment. The real question is something like the following. In standard non-relativistic quantum mechanics, we have probability amplitudes, but we have a deterministic equation of motion, which is the Schrodinger equation. So how do we reconcile probabilities which seem to involve something stochastic with a deterministic equation of motion? And the answer, of course, the standard answer, and of course, not everybody agrees with this. The standard answer is that in a measurement process, there is a non-unitary something or other happening. There's a violation of the Schrodinger equation and something stochastic occurs, producing a definite measurement outcome. Now, in your case, in your development of quantum gravity, you also have what you call the Heisenberg, sometimes called the von Neumann cut between the measuring device and the system. But I couldn't quite see whether this necessarily involves some kind of intrinsic stochasticity. And if it doesn't, what do the probabilities mean?
Okay, so easy question. So first of all, what does probability mean? I'm reading this book here, which is Wayne, Wayne Merrill. It's all about what probability means in physics, and therefore, each chapter I'm changing my mind of what probability. Right. Right? So I'm deeply aware, recently deeply aware of all the mess. So every time I said, "Oh, I got it. I have completely clear what probability means. I know what it is." I read one more chapter, and it's demolished by the careful consideration that you know. So given that, and I don't want to defend any view of probability because I know that I could be wrong. But your question is more specific because it's not what probability means in general. It's what probability means. How do you do I articulate probability in relativity? So I would challenge but I think you would agree, the idea that quantum mechanics is a Schrödinger equation and is a deterministic evolution of the wave function. I think that's I know how popular is in Oxford, extraordinarily popular is in Oxford and in other places of the world, but I think this is a misunderstanding of quantum mechanics. My understanding of quantum mechanics is much more closer to Emily's understanding of quantum mechanics. So, I mean, maybe you can write a background deterministic story if you want by adding ontology, but the actual things we're talking about are quantum events. Think about a flash ontology for simplicity, which are related to one to the other probabilistically. So I don't want to know what's behind what God does behind, but de facto the world I know, it's a discrete world of events that are, as far as I know, related probabilistically, whatever probability means. Now, your question is not about that, because you would say, wait a moment, that's okay, I buy that, but what about the cat? What about the arbitrary choice of the cat? That's the core of relational quantum mechanics, namely that's not the moment perhaps to go into the full discussion, but in relational quantum mechanics, you're describing the world by arbitrarily, that's what we learned from Heisenberg and Bohr, because you can move the cat, arbitrarily breaking the world in pieces in systems and describing how systems affect one another. So given a discrete, given a split, you can say how the system affect another system, another physical system. And the way it does is in a way which is discrete, in discrete quantum events, which are about which we can make probabilistic predictions. So the cat is a source of relationality and is arbitrary. The world isn't divided by a priori. I mean, I can do the quantum mechanics of the individual quarks inside the nucleus or the full molecule. And I have a Hilbert space and observables that tell quantum variables that tell me how the molecules affect the outside. That's my understanding of quantum mechanics. But of course, one problem is how do we think about quantum mechanics? And, you know, I would quote who said, Feynman, who said, the more ways you have to, I don't think the different interpretation of quantum mechanics are alternative. I think they were good. The more we have, the better it is. Quantum, pick one, and to me, the best, what I feel more comfortable with is relational interpretation. Within this, I think quantum gravity can be nicely formulated.
Thank you.
Thanks. Okay, so I see.
Can I add something to this discussion? Sorry, this is Nathan Algaman.
Okay, I just want to make sure we can get to Lucien's question. We're running short on time, but if it's quick, please go ahead.
I just want to ask if you can think of this, think of the diffusion equation. So you have an underlying it, you have an ontology of a random walk. But if you think of the diffusion equation, you have something that's propagating in a deterministic manner. And then when you flash a light and you see where your random walker is, of course this collapses. And then again, you can start another diffusion equation to follow further. So it would seem to me that this would explain why the Schrödinger equation appears deterministic, although the underlying
ontology may be stochastic.
Well, this is essentially a hidden variable theory, and it runs up against all of the no-go results. I'm not saying that they're definitive, but you will face a lot of problems in articulating the dynamics of this hidden variable theory.
Of course, but that's only if you make some assumptions about the arrow of time, which I would like to relax. So I will talk about that tomorrow. I don't want to take too much time.
Wonderful. Thank you. Lucien, do you want to ask your question?
Yeah. So just in response to Carlo, I think that there is a case for reinventing the wheel in the sense that, you know, each generation has a sort of new enthusiasm for conceptual questions. There are reasons for people, you know, addressing these questions afresh, which I'll mention. I've tried to understand loop quantum gravity several times, and I think every time I try again, I understand it better. And your talk just now was very useful. The more I look at it, it looks like it's a remarkable conceptual and technical achievement, you know, that you had to solve both conceptual problems and also quite considerable technical problems to get the sort of finished form that you have. I have concerns, and I think you partially addressed it with your response to Lorenzo, that the way you set it up, it looks like you're baking in a split between space and time. And I think my understanding is that actually you address that question. You have a way of addressing that question. But just coming back to this case for reinventing the wheel, when you sort of look at these conceptual questions again in different contexts, then you might do different things with them. So although you might achieve one resolution in, say, the context of the loop quantum gravity program, you know, when you look at it again, for example, in the context of the general probability theory program, which is something that myself and others have been working on, then you may achieve a different sort of resolution, or you may want to go in a different direction. So it's worth coming back to those questions. And so in terms of the loop quantum gravity program, the sort of question I have, which I think touches on what Lorenzo asked, is if you contrast loop quantum gravity with Einstein's sort of 1915 formulation in terms of field equations of general relativity, that formulation is somehow very local, at least local on the manifold. Whereas the formulation you gave of loop quantum gravity seemed to necessarily be a kind of global formulation that you looked at these different paths. And it also looked like you took a sort of notion of space like hypersurfaces, which is sort of a further sort of violation of the original spirit of what Einstein was doing. So I'm interested in what your reaction is to those points.
Sorry, can't hear you, Carlo. You're muted.
Scott, sorry. Very rapidly, I would love to hear other people's reactions. So I'll answer very rapidly. First, I've nothing against reinventing the wheel. Einstein, Heisenberg, and many other did. What I was preaching is not against reinventing the wheel. Is it reinventing the wheel without paying attention to what has been done so far? That's what I was saying. I mean, those people were, Einstein was deeply aware of all what was going on at this time, and so was Heisenberg. So it's only that. Sorry, I didn't want. I'm not against new ideas. I'm against finding the same ideas again. About breaking space and time. Lucien, we are not far. Let's discuss this in private in one opportunity. There is a mix up between fixing a gauge and breaking space and time, which create confusion. In my book, I have a one way of doing on the space of solutions of Einstein equations, interpreting the phase space as space of solution of Einstein equations, which is one way of getting the same equations in a different language. Abai has another way of doing that. I mean, it's not, here we're not talking about the different technical ways of doing that. there is a sense in which the Willer-DeWitt equation is not an equation that breaks the space and the time direction.
And what about the issue of locality? Einstein's formulation is in some sense local, whereas what you presented looks like it's a very global formulation. Is that something you have a comment on?
It's very good. So first of all, the different levels of request of non-locality in quantum gravity, this stringy ADF-CFT ideology, motivated by some arguments, which are very strong, especially around Princeton in that area, is that you have to go to infinity. Okay, you can only do calculation from infinity to infinity. I and many people in the sort of relativistic community think that those arguments are wrong because they're based on perturbation theory, and if you do things non-perturbative, there are no go arguments for locality, for local, for bulk description are wrong. So Lukoda is much more local, but it's still non-local. That's what you're pointing out. And in fact, I gave sort of the paradigmatic story of a compact region of space-time, but it's not in a point. It's in a region. I think that localities in that sense, which is connect to some of the problems that Emily was bringing out. You forget the rest of the universe. You take some something, sort of the sense of the space-time sense in a compact region of space-time, and you can do physics there. It's local in that sense. You don't need to know what happens before. If you have sufficient initial data, you can compute final data. But quantum gravity is about quantum mechanics, and quantum mechanics about transition amplitudes. And transition amplitude is from, let me use Copenhagen language, from a preparation to a measurement in the Copenhagen lab. So it's always a jump. Again, quantum mechanics is not a Schrödinger evolution. I mean, nobody said it more clearly than Schrödinger himself. He said that the creator of wave mechanics, which means himself, lulled themselves in the illusion of having brought back continuity in physics, but it was a disappointment because wave mechanics by itself is not sufficient. You need the probability of events of something that happened. So there is a non-locality in the sense of you jump from here to here. There is no description of the trajectory in between. There is in the world that we see, there is this kind of non-locality, this kind of discreteness, these quantum leaps, which are, in my opinion, unavoidable. That's wrong. Which to avoid which you have to, overinflate your ontology, and bring in the many walls, bring in the hidden variables, feeling to just fear of emptiness. So you pack everything by adding ontology. You can always get rid of probability, right? You say that what the uncertainty before is just completely coded in the present in something that I don't see. Okay, that's an easy way of getting rid of probability. You can always rework everything as a deterministic theory and a continuous theory if you had hidden variables. Technically, it's difficult, but you can always do that. I think it's easy to accept this.
Carlo, maybe I'm sensitive to the time. I don't want to cut you off, but is that okay? I want to make sure Abhay's been waiting very patiently, as with Marius and others. So
fair the way.
But thanks.
Abhay, do you want to? Can I ask you a question?
Yeah. So I mean, Carlo and I, of course, agree with most of the things, right? We always talk about things, and so his viewpoint that he expressed is very close to mine. But there are two small things that I want to say. I think in answer to Nicola's question, I thought that was a little bit too fast about clocks. I think there's a competition there, and you have to, namely, if you just take a clock, and like the ones that Lorenzo was considering yesterday and so on, then it is true that heavier clock is more accurate, just because, or as Rodolfo was talking about yesterday, because, in the clock frame, we got delta E, delta T, and then this P naught in the clock frame, that is actually uncertain in principle. But on the other hand, when you include gravity, you also include, it creates gravity. And so there is actually a kind of sweet spot. I mean, you don't want one thing or the other things. So it's not that lighter, it's better. No, I think that it is, a relativity says it should be lighter, and uncertainty principle in the clock frame says it should be heavy. So there is a sweet spot somewhere. So this is just a clarification, just because of outside community. But I just wanted to say one more thing, namely that as usual, Carlo gives us clear talks, and you know they're very, very general and so easy to absorb for vast community. But I kind of feel that perhaps there is a little bit impression that in fact there are no problems. But I think there are many, many, many problems in quantum gravity. And so we do need great help from all this community, philosophy of science, information theory, and such thing. And in particular, I think in just one second, which is that Carlo mentioned and other people mentioned string theory, asymptotic safety, etc. But in my view, at least, these because of the way that these theories are constructed, are not really so well geared to talk about issue of time and to talk about the issues that we are discussing in this conference in general. I think loop quantum gravity is the best candidate, I think, in order to make these bridges. But on the other hand, loop quantum gravity is very incomplete. And I think it's incompleteness, in particular, I think that this community could help very much to us, is really, in some sense, we understand the Planck scale thing, how things should happen there, what the Hilbert space should be and how to calculate, these transitions using spin forms and so on and so forth. At least conceptually, we understand that. But I think we're not made great progress in terms of making contact with low energy physics. Again, to zeroth order, yes, but even to first order, we haven't. And so I think, a lot of things having to do with how does the low energy world around us really emerge from this loop quantum gravity. These are conceptual questions. These are philosophical questions. These are also quantum measurement questions, quantum information questions. So we would really greatly appreciate any inputs on these things. And perhaps we could have more discussions about what the open issues are in loop quantum gravity along these lines. So I just wanted to sort of say this just to complete try to complete the discussion. Thank you.
I agree. I have nothing to add, 100%.
So we are a little over time into the informal hangout time, but I do want to take the last two questions because I'm really enjoying the discussion. So I won't be offended if anyone has to leave the Zoom call or anything like that, but I hope this is sufficiently interesting for everyone to hang around. So Marius, do you want to take it away?
Sure. Yeah. I'm not sure what to say because they've said everything. So I copy here in the chat. I dug up the big questions of which we have, I hope, done some infinitesimal progress in this consortium we put up with the QISS, quantum information structural space-time, which actually most people are from quantum information. To help clarify a bit what is the complaint we were making, basically, I think what is being said is that and again, I'm a student of Carl, I'm biased. I know what he thinks. I also know what Abai thinks. When I was doing my PhD, first of all, what we struggled to do is actually define an observable. And this was one of the main things we said, quantum information people do things operationally. They insist on this. And that's something we could understand better because we don't understand very well how to define the meaning of probabilities in quantum gravity. And what does it mean to have an agent there? So that's a big, I think, point of intersection. What I think is a complaint is that somehow what you do when you do quantum gravity is that you try to learn that there is the space, the place of interest where the phenomenon is taking place is somewhere where time and space do not make sense. And if it's going to be the gravitational field, the quantum field, it has to be like that, right? Like matter, imagine how a quantum field is. It's just a mess of quantum fluctuations. You do not have any sort of place where matter is or anything like that. If you're really doing quantum field theory, it's just operators and creation operators. And you have to either do things away with an S matrix or find some way to make sense of it. So, if you lose space and time into your place of interest, you do not have these notions of energy and momentum because these are really associated strictly to classical notions of space and time. And somehow the big idea, which I don't know how much true progress we made in that, was can information replace it? Because information is not clear that it is associated with any notion of background space-time, it seems to be something that is more powerful, more abstract, and lives somehow on its own. You can say have two subsystems and they have neutral information or they don't, for instance. So it's more a comment. This is, I just wanted to say what were the very general motivations we had.
Thanks, Marius. Did anyone on the panel want to comment on that remark briefly? And then we can take Villasani's question.
If none of the other panelists comment, let me just say one thing. I agree with Marius, of course, and I do consider this one of the intriguing and opening questions around. I've been changing my mind repeatedly on that. In the 90s, I wrote the paper with the postulates of quantum mechanics in terms of information, which has, ramificated all over. And I was thinking, let's rewrite everything in terms of information. I've been backtracking a lot somehow, after discussing with all sorts of people, many philosophers in particular, because, information about what in some sense. So information is an incredibly useful tool, but not a point of departure. But I consider this one of the intersecting points where the way of thinking of people like Lucian and so many others, and the way of thinking of a quantum gravity person, which is just jumping out of the Emily called it the Humean mosaic. If I think of the mosaic of a wall, which is space-time, where then in space-time I give the properties to a single point of little regions, is needed. So just to say that this is exactly one of the points that, contrary to what I said before, that when I was talking about reinventing the wheel, this is exactly what interests me. All this formalism that in quantum information is being developed for talking about, for instance, these different observers that are connected in non-causal way, the one to non-partial or ordered way, the one to the others are relevant to quantum gravity. And that's also relevant to Harvey question. What are these boundaries? What is this cat? They're not in space time. They're the pieces that make up space time. The world is made by things that interact with one another, and these interactions make up space time. All this has to be clarified in my mind.
Thank you. All right. So, Villasani, you have the last question.
Okay, thanks very much. First of all, I thank all the speakers for extremely thought-provoking and wonderful talks. My question is for Nicola. So basically, if I understand correctly, you were explaining that the whole intuitionist approach sort of changes our view on classical physics and brings it a bit closer to quantum physics. The broader question is that does it also, so applying the intuitionist approach to quantum physics, does that give us any sort of change in viewpoint? And secondly, like you started with Bell's theorem as a motivation, and the way I understand it, it kind of tells us a difference between how indeterminism is viewed in the classical world and in the quantum world. In the classical case, it's just reflecting our lack of knowledge about pre-existing values, but in the quantum case, we think of it more as some fundamental notion of indeterminism. So is there this distinction even in the intuitionist approach? Because it seemed like even in the classical case, you're heading towards a more fundamental form of indeterminism.
Yes, so thank you for the question. So I think indeed, intuitionism brings classical mechanics closer to quantum mechanics. And then in both cases, indeterminism is completely fundamental. So it's not a matter of just of ignoring hidden variables like that. I mean, these hidden variables do not exist. Real numbers do not exist. And let's say local hidden variables in quantum mechanics also do not exist. So in this sense, it really brings them closer one to the other. And since we have the feeling that we understand classical mechanics relatively well, we have a lot of intuition about classical mechanics, including chaotic systems, where it is maybe a bit not so easy to have a good intuition. But anyway, if we understand classical mechanics and bring it closer to quantum, or bring quantum, sorry, closer to classical, then probably we can, bring classical closer to quantum, then this should indeed shed more light on quantum indeterminacy also, and make quantum indeterminacy easier to accept, because we would have actually, or we have a claim, the same already in classical mechanics. Now, of course, you may ask, we have the quantum measurement problem. Now we may have also a classical measurement problem. You know, what are probabilities, as Harvey was saying? When does indeterminate quantity become determinate? Again, I think if we just stick to quantum, we have this quantum measurement problem since Schrödinger, and before Schrödinger, we made essentially zero progress, not much. I mean, maybe we reinvented the wheel several times here. With some progress, I would say zero progress is, of course, a bit an exaggeration, but not much. And maybe if we now address that in a framework of classical mechanics, the chances that we make progress is maybe larger just because we are asking another question in a framework where we have the feeling we understand all that. There's no non-locality here. It's somehow a much cleaner framework in which to ask this same or at least similar question. But I have, again, also to admit, I didn't do that yet. So this is still a work in progress. What we did more with my co-worker, Flavio Del Santo, was to address relativity and indeterminacy in relativity with this conclusion that indeterminacy itself is also relative. This is what I said at the very end of my talk, maybe a bit too briefly. And indeed, it would be now a good... It is time now to address quantum mechanics and see whether indeed my hope will turn, let's say, correct, and there is some progress or not. I don't know yet.
Carlo, you were saying something. Just the last quick question was so what, according to you, sort of gives quantum mechanics its power? Maybe, like, you know, and we've seen that in information processing tasks and things like this, but now if really this interpretation of indeterminacy is sort of the same in the classical and quantum world, then how do I understand this apparent power of quantum mechanics over classical, or how do I interpret Bell's theorem?
You still have differences between quantum and classical. For instance, entanglement is a typical quantum phenomenon, violation of Bell inequality is a quantum phenomenon, and so on. So you still have a big difference. And you have Hilbert spaces. I mean, all that machinery remains for quantum, and you don't have all that. What you have now in classical mechanics, if you go to intuitionistic mathematics, is this indeterminacy. But the rest, all the other aspects of quantum, again, entanglement, for instance, superposition, all that remains typical of quantum.
Right. I mean, the derivation of Bell's theorem will probably change, right? Because you don't assume hidden variables even in the classical case. This is what I meant. Yeah.
No, for the derivation of Bell inequality, you don't need real numbers. I mean, you have usually one bit, or at least a finite set of possible measurement settings, finite set of results, and even the number of hidden variables. Mm-hmm. If you have only finitely many inputs and outputs, everything is discrete. So you can really do that with where everything is discrete, finite and discrete.
Right. Okay. Thanks for clarifying. And sorry to interrupt you, Carlo.
No, I interrupted you. Do I have time to a comment? I want to react to this.
I don't want to say no, so go for it.
I just want to offer my reaction to all this intuitionist talk. Just take it as a, as a first reaction. I mean, I might change my mind. So a lot of what you said, I found it very convincing. And I don't want to enter into any story about foundational mathematics. That's not my field, so I stay out for it. But from a physics point of view, I found it very powerful, many things you were saying. The sense in which classical mechanics with chaos is non-deterministic is stronger than what we usually teach students. I definitely agree, and it comes very close to the sense in which quantum mechanics is non-deterministic. And in fact, in both cases, you can reconstruct determinism by assuming assuming things which are not outside your domain. I mean, you can do determinism with de Broglie-Bohm. Of course, there are differences, as you say. I don't want to underplay the differences, but if you take a finitist perspective, the difference becomes very, very weak. So I see the point. It's very, very good. And a number of things you also said overall. In fact, I'm pretty convinced that the reals are not real. And I think that's a solution of so many silly puzzles. I heard recently Tim Maudling talking about the probability when I throw something to go as one specific point, and when I mean, that's not about reality, it's about something else. There's no specific real point you hit when you talk about probability and so on. But there's one point which I could not digest with my philosophy, my prejudices, and I just want to put on the table, which is the arrow of time, because you seem to connect the indeterminacy you're talking about with a passage from the past to the future. And it seems to me that the non-determinacy you're talking about, which is the one of quantum mechanics, or even the one of chaos, in quantum mechanics and in classical mechanics and in all about basic theory, is just completely toward the future and toward the past. So, I mean, given the present, we can equally non-predict the future or the past. And the reason we see differences between the future and the past comes only and strictly only when we bring in a macroscopic variables, when we explicitly ignore variables that we could measure, but we don't measure, not we couldn't measure. Plus a contingent fact about the fact that the past is strange with respect to these macroscopic variables, as low entropy, the past hypothesis, whatever. But it's not a story about the difference between the past and the future. It's not a story about the quantum mechanical.
So Carlo, maybe I interrupt you. Sorry for that, but I understand what you're saying, and I find that very interesting. And actually, we Flavio, we are indeed considering equally that you could have an open future, you could have an open past.
Then I would buy the ticket of your party. If you went that way, I would join the party.
Okay. Let's not jump too fast. But anyway, so you know the idea that in the past there is really destruction of information. Of course, there are many things we cannot access, but I'm not talking about practicalities here. But one could really assume in this framework also that information about the past, maybe the remote past, but I don't know exactly what that means, get really destroyed. Like you have new information getting created, sure. Past information get destroyed, sure. Completely destroyed. Sure. And that would restore, well, fully, partially, I'm not yet clear about that, but it partially at least would restore the symmetry that you are after.
The two information postulate of quantum mechanics they had in the 90s is one that information is bounded. So if you have a finite region of space-time, you have a finite number of things you can distinguish. And the second is that you can always get more information. And of course, the apparent contradiction is because I'm talking about relevant information, the one you can use to predict the future or the past. And the point is that when you get some information, you destroy some information, right? When you get spin off in the X direction, you destroy the information. Yeah. So I understand what you're talking about. Good. So you're not so far, after all, from the possibility of not having an indeterminacy strictly tied to the direction of the arrow of time. You might consider this.
Okay, I'm not sure yet. I don't know. But yeah, anyway, thank you for the question.
Well, that's great. I know we're 20 minutes over time, but I think it was worth it. So maybe we can thank everyone again. And we also have the Remo session now.